to the Return of the Ancestors gathering, which we're coming here in the next 3 weeks.
So that's the April 18th to the 28th, is that correct?
That is right.
And when Asher was here a couple of weeks ago, he spoke about each of us moving to a place of healing the ancestral memories so that we as people can all move forward, and that will be addressed at the gathering as well as a global healing.
Yes, yeah. It's really important for this time for the healing of the ancestral memory all the way back generations. Once we do that, we ask to go generations to generations and generations back from grandmother to grandfather and on, way back, so that we can move through this transition. A lot of people are talking about 2012, as in 2012 being another doorway or positioning in the galactic or planetary alignments for us to go through. Now we have an awakening time here that we can become awakened and be conscious through this shift, and in part of the message is healing this ancestral memory. And as we do that, so that when we begin this next cycle, that we don't have to repeat ourselves over again in going through the same pain and suffering and dogmatic roles that we have as humanity for thousands of years.
Now, did many elders throughout the world have this vision as well for this healing to happen at this time? Because
yeah,
it is so important.
Traveled. Yes, we've just made, in the last 2 years, we've traveled around the world meeting with the wisdom keepers and elders, prophecy keepers and historians and herstorians. And yes, they're very similar of that healing, the teachings. And they really have that. It's something I believe we have lost, but we're remembering the tools or the techniques in this process. And to agree, part of this gathering too is say, hey, yes, we agree, and let's begin to take the first steps towards this. And it's thought we have to do this with ourselves first, then our families, our communities, our states, our countries, and the world.
Yes.
It starts there.
And there will be ceremonies to address this healing.
Yes, there'll be representations of ceremonies from delegations from Aymara, from Bolivia, South America, Peru. There'll be delegations for all the way from Guatemala, from the Maya. There'll be delegations from the Lakota Nation, from North America.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be delegations from India coming. There'll be delegations from Europe, all over many countries and continents. And we're welcoming even more international and national delegations to come share their ceremonials and their sacred fires, their sacred culture, their music, their dance.
Yes.
To express this and to dance for that healing of the ancestral memory.
Adam Illebird, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the role of prophecy in the coming together of this event, and how the, I think particularly you mentioned that the Mayan and the Hopi had some correlations between what they saw in their, was it origin creation legends and also prophecies, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. If you go back, or we've been sitting with back and forth with the Maya and Hopi and all in between, basically throughout the Americas, which I call another process that's taking place, the bridging of the Americas. You find the similarity that they are as one people, or as of one ancestral wisdom and knowledge or tradition that rooted from certain regions and came out in certain periods of time. They believe that we are leaving fourth world into fifth world, next cycle. And they've tracked this. Actually, the Mayans were the day keepers. And so they've tracked this for thousands of years, this cycle and this alignment that takes place, and where the different suns came. We're on moving towards the sixth sun, fifth world, from fourth to fifth world, fifth to sixth sun. So that's all been written in their tablets and their prophecies, and bits and pieces have gotten out to the general public about this, but they said it's now more than ever that the prophecies must be shared from the Maya, from the Hopi, Now, there is some controversy. Is it time? Do we share it by some within inside of the internal nations or tribes, or let's say, you know, there is some controversy in that, but those that have been getting the dreams and visions and the spokespeople of the of their nations feel that it is time to share what is appropriate to the general public about those prophecies. And we're literally right in the middle of fulfillment of the ending of the prophecies that have been given. We're in the doorway now, right before many of them will be renewed. In the next 3 years, moving on through above and beyond 2012, a lot of those will be have renewed. And it's an opportunity for us now to create or co-create this vision for a new direction for a new humanity, where we want to go.
Mm.
So, you know, it's in the past, maybe several civilizations have taken a route of devastation or destruction or self, you know, elimination in that manner, you know, put it brief. But I believe as a whole, we're going to we choose to make a change in this cycle. So this is what they're sharing, too. It's up to us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sharing, too, it's about taking responsibility. And it's each individual's responsibility. We can't put that on to one nation, one tribe, one culture. It's all about the all my relations, the mitakui awasanas, the Lakotas
yes.
would share. So it's very that we all come together. It's not about how many. It's about the quality, not the quantity either here.
Mm-hmm.
And the delegate and our focus and the intention of this meeting.
So I understand that this is open to all open-hearted, good people who want to participate in this. That doesn't matter if you're white or what race you are. That it's open to all. Is that correct?
That is true. This is indigenous and non-indigenous peoples are welcomed. There will be also the backgrounds of scientific, some scientific terms, and spiritual and traditional peoples. This is not only for the elders and wisdom keepers, but also our youth to be involved. Now, we have asked for a contribution, you know, or a registration fee, and that fee is going to support these elders and youth and wisdom keepers coming in from around the world to be here with us. Without that, you know, we're a grassroots organization. Without that contribution or that giveaway of the monetary resource, then it would be hard for us to do this. We've done it without any grants or funding that way. It's coming from the people, so we've just been that much grateful, you know, to the people for that. Also, we have programs set up for volunteering to get involved through
yes.
volunteering programs. We also have for the delegation, if someone can't make it or if one individual or a grouping can make it, here the doors are open, but if you can't, we have Get Involved nationally and internationally, where people can go onto the website, you can click on Get Involved nationally and internationally, and it walks you through the process where you can create a gathering with the base protocols that we've set up to connect in and send an email the name of your event and gathering from wherever you are in the world to link in, mm-hmm. and we'll post them on the website.
And your webpage is Earthworks for Humanity. Is
actually,
that correct?
That's one of our latest sites that we've launched now. It's we should direct everyone to is InstituteForCulturalAwareness.com.
InstituteForCulturalAwareness.com.
Right.
And is there, I imagine there's a listing of what's going to be taking place as well.
Yeah, April 1st we'll have a full agenda and a schedule.
That
will be posted. Yes.
It looks like there already is a schedule outline.
Right. Really brief, day to day, but we have a more hour by hour schedule being released April 1st, and some more pictures and the
Great.
Delegates that will be attending. And we're actually still looking for support, you know, to those listeners that are out there.
Yes.
We could really use the support to continue to help, whether it's monetarily, or sending giftings in. People are mailing us giftings from all over the world at this point. We want to make this the most beautiful experience for some of our delegates that have never left their countries, their lands before.
Yes.
And we're still needing the support, you know, to monetarily achieve our goals. And so there's an explanation there of how to donate or how to get involved that way. We're also going to be, the Mayans will be hosting 2 to 3 sacred Mayan fire ceremonies, along with the Aymara fire ceremonies in, from India. So we're having people mail in copal resins, flowers, incenses, candles. We're raising, you know, we're asking for 5,000 candles. We're also asking people to send in bedding or covers or materials to help in the housing of. Our internal camp is over several hundred people, so it's quite
the magnitude.
Yes.
And you spoke again about the importance of all of us taking responsibility for leading our lives and the world in a more positive direction overall. And are there going to be specific instructions and guidance at the gathering?
Oh, how we can do that?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, they'll be sharing in council. There'll be the elders and wisdom keepers always lead by example. And if we pay attention to their actions or what they're doing, then we learn. But they'll be sharing simplicity, simple things of how to begin to take responsibility. For example, just living in harmony with one another, living in harmony and taking care of Mother Earth, feeding the earth, praying, making your offerings, gratitude and thanks, to make a little prayer every day, every morning, to reconnect. Simplicity, you know, start planting your food, get your seeds, you know, your sacred, and grow your own food. So, again, that's basically things that they'll be sharing, but they'll be sharing many other inspirational messages to humanity of how we can do that. How can we utilize the tools of today? Keep in balance the material and spiritual. You know, in a way, we've gone super material.
Yes.
Well, we can utilize the material and still keep a balance of the spiritual wisdom and knowledge and cultures and traditions. So this is what they're going to share, because a lot of these wisdom keepers do have to use the technologies and the airplanes and the transportation. So they're just going to share of how we can bring a balance back into the material and spiritual world to catapult us into the next day.
Beautiful. And also, the last time you were on, you spoke about exploring the mysteries a bit of the seen and the unseen worlds.
Yes.
And how is that going to be addressed in
the unseen
continuum of time?
Well, it's what I call it is a call and a response. Hmm. We are putting the call out, and we see the response. And as we see it here on the scene, as we come together, men, women, and children, community, ceremonial people, leaders, our ancestors in the same respect for those that cannot see, and there's others, those are attuned to those areas or realms, that they are rejoicing. They are giving gratitude and thanks. And it's like we do something and the elements respond. Sometimes we can't see. Well, what is that? That's wind. So you pray, we come together, and then a confirmation of wind comes, or the elements. So it's a rejoicing, and it's a lot to do with the ancestral, or the angelic, or the spiritual worlds that that take place there, too, of the unseen. And, you know, just knowing that that's all that support is there for humanity to continue and to be lifted in the new direction.
So I guess one of the themes is that our prayers and our energy can have a strong effect. A lot of people who are just in political movements and not oriented towards the spiritual as much might think that's not very effective, but in this context, you feel it is.
Yes. Yeah, well, for example, one of the things is We've been doing this for many years. Actually, since I was a teenager, I began this, and what I call earth acupuncture. And we set an intention. We go out to the sacred sites, the lands, the springs, the mountaintops, the vortexes, the sacred regions, and we make these prayers, and we put the call out for reconnection of the meridian system, not only of our body, but of Mother Earth. And so when you do that, you actually begin healing thyself and Earth. And so you can, we've brought scientists, doctors, mathematicians, and studying this over the years, and it actually does have a cause and effect. So we have tangible evidence and knowledge that it brings back the harmony into the natural world. So we're actually, just like acupuncturists would do in the clinical studies with the body, with human body, we are divine instruments of light, implementing that prayer of intention back into the earth to activate and recalibrate and anchor that energy back to reconnect her natural system. So it's actually, that's one example of effectiveness of intention of prayer and healing for humanity and Mother Earth.
And would you say that when a number of us all do that together and harmonize well, then we get a very strong synergistic effect, quite, what would you say, stronger than the sum of the parts?
Yes, it amplifies. We are water, majority of water. When you get electromagnetic current going...
And good evening, and my apologies to the listening audience. This is Robert Norris, and you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And I'm a bit late this evening, 15 minutes or more. So let's begin with a little music and then roll right into the show. Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, and away we'll go.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading, heroes enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you
tell me over and over and over again, my friend, I you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Understand what I'm trying to say, and can't you feel the fears that I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away, there'll be no one to save with the world in a gray. Take a look around you, boy, it's bound to scare you, boy, and you
tell me over and over and over again, my friend, how you doing?
China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace.
That, of course, was Eve of Destruction by the Turtles. So, kind of the Barry Maguire is the more familiar one, but that was another one. And it's a good song, even though it's 40-plus years old. And we need some songs like it. I guess we got some songs like it. I just haven't found them recently. Still getting, hoping Skidmark Bob do some looking around for those songs. Anyway, we are at www.freakradio.org and 101.1 FM, as I think I mentioned, at least in part before. The show goes from usually from 6 to 8. I guess today it's going to be a little abbreviated. And we got a number of things happening here. One of them is the studio speakers don't work too well, so we get the interesting phenomenon of hearing one side of stereo albums, which is interesting. I think we've got some working mics in the studio. Let's see how that goes. Not sure where we're at, but we'll see if we can roll forward. The phone number here is 427-3772. We're in area code 831. In case you want to call in, 831-427-3772. If you want to catch me off air, it is 831-423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 4833. 423-4833 for off-air communications. Also, if you want to leave a message for anybody in the collective, if you're interested in some other show, for instance, the show that preceded this one, which was, I believe, a rerun, you want to know what it's all about, maybe hear more of it, maybe get more information about it, you can call the studio, actually it's the collective voicemail line at 427-4523, 427-4523, and you can also, of course, go on the line, online, I should say, at freakradio.org, in case you want to get even more information, schedules, you want to download an application, and so forth. So that's an option you have. A couple of notes. This doesn't look like this microphone working. I don't know. I think this one is. They're playing around here in the studio. Oh, sorry. Let's see where we're at here. Okie doke. We've got, of course, coming up tomorrow, as some of you follow the show regularly know, there is a hearing in Department 4 for two homeless musicians, Anna Richardson and Miguel De Leon, who are charged with public nuisance for essentially sleeping outside downtown. And I actually talked about that at the last city council meeting, which was on Tuesday, and I'll be playing that fairly soon, just so we can go back and get the city council out of the way. I got a lot of old, it's not that old actually, but it's unaired interviews on the street that I want to talk about, or actually I want to play. They speak for themselves. And I'm going to have a long show on Sunday, assuming I make it into the studio and don't forget my tapes, as sometimes happens. That's at 7:30 in the morning for all of you insomniacs, or I don't know, people who go to early mass, or folks who just happen to like to get up at 7:30, or people who can't sleep, whatever. It's 7:30 in the morning. Thomas Levitt's wake-up call will be preempted by my elongated version of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the name of this show. And Bathrob Spears Broadsides normally begins at 9:30. It's going to begin at 7:30 on Sunday because Thomas is down south visiting relatives and has asked me to take over his show, so I will take over his show and do what I usually do, which is to use the time to give people on the streets who don't have an opportunity to speak more time to speak around issues that I think are important, and presumably they do too, or well, we'll see if you think they're important. Again, 10 a.m. tomorrow, Miguel de Leon and Anna Richardson go to a very bizarre injunction hearing pushed by city attorneys John and Susan Barisone, costing thousands of dollars, if not tens of thousands of dollars, in order to essentially terrify homeless people, particularly this couple, into either leaving town or somehow meekly walking in every time they get a sleeping ticket and asking to, please don't give me the $97 fine, but make me pay $25 to Community Options to do 8 hours of community service so I can sleep for one more night. I mean, it's outrageous and absurd on its face, but it's the policy of the Santa Cruz City government until hopefully the courts, as they have in Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Laguna Beach, changed the situation. Of course, it was court decisions that also encouraged the city council in Richmond to change its law. And Palo Alto, for some strange reason, has had an enlightened you-can-sleep-in-your-vehicle law, which lets you sleep in your vehicle, provided you're not breaking windows or, you know, crapping on the street or dumping oil in, down the drain. You know, it's here in Santa Cruz, however, we know better. We know that sleep is a precursor to greater crimes, the broken windows theory, and therefore you don't want to allow a homeless person to sleep because that only leads to burglaries, mayhem, drug dealing, and all kinds of questionable behavior. And if you believe that, I have a number of bridges I'd like to sell you in different cities, so think about that. Tonight is also an open mic at the Sub Rosa Cafe. Starts at 8 o'clock. I guess you start signing up at 7. Eric, who is a poet I've known for some time, is going to be speaking, doing a memorial for his brother, who 20 years ago, he tells me, was shot dead by San Diego cops. And so if you want to check that out at the Sub Rosa Cafe, that's going on. And I'm going to swing, I think, directly into a few... What do I want to do first here? Well, let me just say this, because this has really been the thing I've been working on most intently, and you can actually read about it online. If you go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, which is indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, you can find a story entitled Soup on the Sidewalk, a Community Dialogue. And this concerns a demonstration dialogue we had yesterday outside of Jack's Hamburger Joint, which is a restaurant kitty corner from the farmer's market at Lincoln and Cedar. Farmer's market, of course, is only every Wednesday downtown, but many of you who are listening to the station know the location of the farmer's market. Probably as many know the location of Jack's Hamburgers, which is right next to the Nickelodeon. And I'm going to be playing some tape from that. Some of it tonight, probably most of it on Sunday, for those of you who want to follow it more closely. But the bottom line here is, as I said at City Council, and I think you're going to hear that tape tonight, there is a really been, I think, a lot of positive developments in this whole interaction. A number of members of the community who are homeless have accused Jack's of discriminating against homeless people, mainly because they didn't like them clustering on the lawn of the Calvary Episcopal Church, the red church right across from Jack's. That's the claim of the homeless folks, and it's a pretty consistent claim. On the other hand, if you talk to Connie, who is the owner, or perhaps one of the owners of Jack's Hamburgers, she tells us that, no, that's not it, that we have only gotten... been forced to tell people to leave who were violating health and safety rules, such as bringing in their dogs, changing a diaper on the table, maybe carrying weapons or things that looked like weapons that might have, you know, caused some consternation with the customers, like, I guess, nunchucks or some such thing, who brought a cup of across the street of coffee for refills, which they hadn't paid for, and other things that were actually behavioral problems at Jack's Hamburgers. There's a real difference of opinion depending on who you talk to, and you're going to hear the stories of at least one side. Connie has not agreed to be recorded on this, though she's been very gracious enough to have a lot of conversations with me, and the bottom line here is that she has said, whatever the difference of opinion, we are happy to have those who have been even told they can't come back to Jack's to come back in, talk to us. If you agree to, you know, not bring your dog in, if you agree to not shout and swear, although some of the folks say they've shouted and sweared after they were excluded, and that was the reason they shouted and swore. But, you know, if they agree to this, that they're welcomed to be to buy burgers at Jack's or whatever else. Jack's, I think, has good burgers. There are those who disagree with me, but I like the food. It's because I guess I'm a hapless carnivore, you know, or a hopeless carnivore, and occasionally I like to sneak a hamburger into the Nickelodeon when I'm going to the movies there. So it's a positive outcome, and if you want to go online, you can read the flyer that I put out on this issue and also the response that the Jack's management have. And I'm going to read what Jack's response was right now. So for those of you who don't have access to a computer, Jack's will not discriminate against customers because of their homeless status. Jack's will not be punishing or retaliating against those who are hanging around nearby at other places off Jack's property but who have violated none of Jack's rules. They will not be refused service, even if the management would prefer that folks not assemble on the church lawn, for instance. Jack's will allow those who have been previously 86th in the last 2 months to return, provided they agree to abide by health and safety regulations. Jack's management may ask for one-on-one conversations with those who have had problems in the past to reassure everyone concerned. Jax asks customers to recognize that they are in a confined space where folks come to enjoy a meal. We ask you to avoid swearing, screaming, and loud abusive language that may disturb other customers who wish to eat in peace. Jax will clarify for those who don't know what their particular concerns are and have been in the last few months. These include not smoking in or near the restaurant, not coming back with used cups and getting extra beverages, mellow language, no diaper changing on the tables, and no non-service dogs on the property. We also ask customers to pick up their orders promptly or be prepared to suffer cold food without complaint. If folks decline to abide by these rules when asked, they'll be asked to leave. If asked to leave, please do so. If you wish to appeal this decision or discuss it with the owner, please call Connie at Jax at 423-4421 or at home, and she was gracious enough to give her home number, at 429-8870. You can also contact Rene, who is the groundskeeper and one of the managers of the Monday Calvary Episcopal Coffee House, which happens once a week, at 851-0444. And if these numbers, if you miss these numbers, you're welcome to call, leave a message, and I'll get them to you. 423-4833 is the number to call, 423-4833. I'll pick up my messages later, but it's also online. All this is online under indiebay.org/Santa Cruz and the story about sipping soup on the sidewalk. Yeah. Jax asks customers to be sensitive to the volume and rhythm of the customer flow at Jax and limit their time to a reasonable period considering others who are waiting. And if problems arise, Jax agrees to contact Rene of the Calvary Episcopal as possible mediator and encourages youth and homeless to do the same if they have problems. Again, her number is 851-0444. So I think what we have here is, at least as it's proposed, and I think that I see by talking to kids who have been excluded from Jax and who feel angry about it but are willing to set aside those feelings and go back there if insofar as they've been regular customers in the past or just even occasional customers. And also Connie, the owner, who has taken a lot of time working, helping thrash out these her concerns and putting them together. I think it's really a positive step. I for one, put out a flyer on behalf of Huff. It's actually my flyer. It hasn't been officially ratified by Huff, but I haven't heard anybody objecting to it, and I passed it around a bit. It's called Human Rights Problems in Santa Cruz, The Road Forward. Santa Cruz is a town where it is illegal to sleep or cover up with blankets at night after 11 p.m. if you are homeless. In January, the Downtown Association Chamber of Commerce and Downtown Neighbors got City Council to make not paying $397 sleeping tickets a jailing offense. Sitting down on any sidewalk in Santa Cruz within 14 feet of a building is illegal. More and more benches are being removed from downtown and time limits for sitting instituted. It is forbidden to enter parks after dark. Homeless survival gear is being seized and destroyed when found by Chief Ranger Wallace or his goon squads. The city attorney is spending thousands of dollars to jail two homeless street performers, I mentioned this earlier, Anna and Miguel, for unpaid sleeping tickets, using an injunction which will send them immediately to jail for contempt if they sleep at night, as it's illegal to sleep at night in Santa Cruz outside or in a vehicle after 11 o'clock. In a town with shelter for 40 to 60 people tonight, with 1,500 to 2,000 outside. Even though Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, and Laguna Beach all allow sleeping outside. I mentioned that before, too. Young and homeless people complained that they were being turned away from Jax. They said the owner didn't like their congregating on the lawn of Calvary Episcopal Church across the street. Since then, the church, under pressure from nearby businesses, in spite of a successful Monday 4 to 8 p.m. Calvary Coffee House, has banned homeless people from its lawns, except on Monday afternoons and Wednesday afternoons when there's the coffee house and a farmer's market, respectively. Workers at Jax confirmed that numerous folks have been turned away. And Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, put out a flyer a week ago calling for a protest and a boycott of Jax until it changed its policies. Jax agreed to discuss and clarify. Connie, an owner of Jax, contacted Huff and presented her side of the story, explaining that the problems were those of individual behavior. She denied there was any policy of discrimination against the homeless. She agreed to allow a return of those told to leave if they'd follow the rules. She worked with Huff to clarify her concerns. She agreed not to discriminate against people simply for being in a group across the street, and we continue to work out the solution. We ask for respect of both sides in this situation. Homeless people have less and less public space in Santa Cruz. That's not the fault of Jax. That's not the fault even of Calvary Episcopal Church, though they are, by removing their lawns as a place where people can hang out, they are contributing significantly to that problem, in my view, and removing a sort of a safety valve. But the real people involved are the police and the city council and the city manager and the city staff and those who are pressuring them to essentially drive poor and homeless people out of town and out of sight. Merchants are under greater pressure because of the Depression. Help end the anti-homeless laws downtown, encourage businesses to agree to a general mediation policy, and support civil rights for the poor in Santa Cruz. That's a flyer that you can download off of Santa Cruz Indie Media or indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. And again, these are flyers that have to do with the whole situation at Jack's and how people can actually work things out. And frankly, whatever the facts are, whatever side you're on this, you want to see, I think, businesses be able to thrive and the entire community be able to patronize them. And that is hopefully what is happening here. So sometimes calling for a boycott of a business and raising an issue in a strong, angry way can actually cause a dialogue that results in really fruitful results. And I think that, and it's too early to tell for sure where this is all going, but it looks very positive to me, and I certainly hope that's what's happening. So I'm going to play now a little bit, just going directly to the last city council meeting, which was on Tuesday. It was an afternoon meeting, and I'll begin playing a bit of it now. There isn't too much I want to play. I should say that before the council meeting happened, there was a closed session of the city council, and that's where they meet in private with their risk manager, I think, and their city attorney and staff and select people whom they invite to discuss what they call litigation and personnel matters, which they feel they have to do privately. A lot, I think far too much is done privately, but one of those issues that came up on Tuesday was my claim against the city for damages because two of their police officers, Sergeant Sanders and Officer Albert, falsely arrested me way back in November of last year. They didn't take me to jail, but they publicly humiliated me, banned me from public property, and sent me into a court runaround involving a $248 citation that is still being adjudicated in the courts, even as we speak. I went to trial on it, and I talked about it. I'm still hoping to get the audio of the trial so it can be played here on the air so people can hear it. It's kind of interesting. The issue, as I've talked about before, has to do with the right to be in public spaces, and more important, the right of a reporter to investigate complaints of homeless discrimination in public spaces. Because what happened was two guys heard what they called religious sermons coming over the public loudspeakers Sunday, November 2nd, back last year. They came down and told me about this and said that the guard had treated them rudely and refused to take their complaints. I went there, tried to talk to the guard. He treated me rudely. He told me to leave the property. I said, no, it's public property. I talked to a supervisor who was not rude, who understood my concerns, not because the security guard directed me to the supervisor, because the supervisor happened to show up. His name was Ed Nelson. And he then apparently got this religious sermonizing turned off, which is appropriate. He didn't have any real response to my saying, please also instruct your security guards to say who they are and to give their supervisor's name if they don't want to talk to me. I mean, I want to have somebody else who I can talk to about an issue, and I also want to be able to complain about their behavior if, you know, it's inappropriate, as it was in my case, and it may have been in the case of these two men who drew my attention to the situation and asked me to go there in the first place. So I came back an hour later, and I found a couple, I think one of the guys had come back there who I talked to before, another person who I'd been interviewing about abuses against the homeless in the Poganip by Chief Ranger Wallace. We began talking, and a security guard came over and wanted to talk to me, and I said, give me your name and your badge number. And he refused, and I said, I kept repeating my request, and he refused and said he was calling the police. Well, he called the police. He filed a trespass charge against me. The police department upheld this, even though this is the bus station. And the idea that a security guard, because he doesn't want to give his name and his badge number, and he also objected to my tape recording him. you know, I think that a tape recording is the safest and most objective, perhaps unless you have a videotape recorder or a camcorder, way of documenting what goes on if you are being approached by a police officer or a security guard. So it seemed perfectly reasonable to me. Plus, I'm a reporter, so it's another reason I carry a tape recorder, because I pass on what happens to the media. I pass it to the public and to folks generally. And I did that. In fact, I played the whole thing. If you go back to the website huffsantacruz.org and click on the name of the show, Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides, you can actually hear the whole shindig. It's back in a November show, and it's go to the descriptions of Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides, name of the show, and you'll be able to find it. If you're interested, give me a call on the Huff line. I'll kind of help you out with that. But in any case, the city has known about this. I let them know the audio. You want to hear what happened? Here's what happened. Here's everything the guard said. Here's everything I said. Here's what happened at the Metro. Well, the city's response to that was to continue to take me to criminal court and try to fine me for this. And my response for that was to sue the city and say, bullshit. Your responsibility is to make sure your police are properly trained. Your responsibility is not to harass homeless people at the Metro, and particularly not reporters who are trying to find out what's going on at the Metro. So that kind of brings me back to where we were a moment ago. I went into the closed session of the City Council on Tuesday, which doesn't happen in the City Council chambers, but in the room behind the City Council chambers. And I presented what's called my, you're allowed, any member of the public in theory is allowed to speak at the closed session, and then they have to leave. This is what's called the open interval before the closed session begins, if they want to comment for the City Council on what closed items they're going to be discussing. That you can't really know too much about the closed items unless they're your items, or possibly a friend has a lawsuit, or maybe it's a union dispute, but you're allowed to go comment, or a lawsuit against the boardwalk for seizing the public property and ripping off the community with the connivance of the City Council, as has been happening regularly for the last 20 years and longer. But you are allowed to speak at this open interval. So I did. I went in and spoke, and at some point I guess I'll read you, I may read you my speech. And I essentially presented to the City Council the fact that they not only were trying to ban me from public space with their police, they not only were punishing me for First Amendment activity there, they were not only denying me access to the bus, and I was doing not disrupting service in any way, they were not only supporting essentially police state tactics by security guards who have much better things to be doing than harassing reporters, but they weren't even instructing their police to use the proper law. There's a specific law that you have to use, because it was passed by the City Council in the 80s. It has to do with the Metro Transit Authority and the Metro Transit Authority alone. That is to say, the property and the bus stops. And that is, if you're going to be banned from any of this property, they have to give you a written notice. They have to, it can't be more than 14 days. They have to provide you for an appeal. They have to suspend the ban unless there is evidence of real disruption or danger. None of this was done. So they're legally liable. They got their asses hanging out big time. And I presented this to them and said, not just my case, but I don't want you going after other people around this. That's really the reason that I'm following this issue. You know, I mean, that's the point. So they held their closed session, and then what they usually do typically is at 3 o'clock they turn down all the claims, almost without exception. Anybody who has a claim against the city, they say, forget it, go to court, and then, you know, we'll see you there. This makes money for the city attorney. It costs money for everybody else, but apparently city attorney isn't a powerful figure, and they trust John Barisoni, so they let him do pretty much, I'm getting the impression, of what he wants to do. You know, I don't sit on the inner council, so maybe there's a lot of opposition, but I've never heard that was the case. So if anybody who's in the know wants to tell me that Barisoni is frequently stopped by the City Council from frivolous lawsuits or frivolous attacks on people, like, he's the one who's doing the lawsuit against these two tomorrow in Department 4 at 10 o'clock for sleeping, the civil injunction, which they don't even have an attorney for, except that an attorney happened to come forward. The city doesn't have to prove they're guilty of any crime, just find them a, quote, public nuisance, and then it's as though they were guilty of a crime, and they could be put in jail. just because they're found sleeping somewhere in the city, and the judges ruled that's a matter of they have to follow all laws, and that's a violation of the law. So that the kind of outrages that the Barrisonis are making hay off of as city attorneys. Anyway, so what we're going to hear now is, first we're going to hear oral communication, which is the period where at city council supposedly have 30 minutes to speak. That is to say, there's a 30-minute period for the public to speak, and the public is supposed to, you know, divide this up. And in the past, it's been 3 minutes. In the recent past, long ago, it was 10 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was a much longer period of time you were allowed. You had to divide it up with those who were there. But Matthews, our mayor, Cynthia Matthews, has made it 2 minutes, hence my moniker for her, 2-Minute Matthews. So here is some tape from some selections, plus some commentary about the city council's Tuesday meeting, at least parts of it that concern me and that interest me and that I'm going to pass on to you.
So here we have the May 26th Santa Cruz City Council meeting recorded off of a videotape, selections from it. This is the oral communications segment. It appears around 3 o'clock, probably a little bit after. I think there's usually a presentation. And the entire council is there except for Tony Madrigal. And the afternoon session is where this is happening. There's only an afternoon session. Cynthia Matthews has canceled the evening session. And as I point out, when I speak, either when I speak at oral communications or at another point, 2-Minute Matthews, as I call the mayor, has limited oral communication to 2 minutes per person, even though there's supposed to be a 30-minute period for people to speak and only about 6 or 7 speakers. For those who are interested, you are allowed to, if you contact the mayor in advance on behalf of an organization, you can get a 5-minute interval to speak at. And she has been fairly diligent about that, provided you contact her in advance.
Members of the community, I want to commend Jack's, the tasty hamburger joint at Lincoln and Cedar. Unlike the city council, they seem to be responding to concerns about homeless discrimination there. What we initially planned as a public protest tomorrow at 3 p.m. on the sidewalk is now likely to be a meeting of minds and hearts and stomachs, with the process being developed as to how to begin with a clean slate. Homeless people receiving and giving respect at local restaurants, how refreshing if this works out. I hope other cafes who have problems with customers will adopt the kind of approach that Jack's management seems to be taking. There will be free hot soup on the sidewalk at 3 p.m. tomorrow at Lincoln and Cedar near Jack's Hamburger Place. For those who want to attend and for anyone in the community, everyone is welcome. On the other hand, we have City Attorney John Barrisoni, reading as I talk, spending tens of thousands of dollars to jail or exile two homeless musicians, Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon. Their crime, roll the drums please, sleeping outside and not paying their sleeping tickets. Shelter space tonight for 5% of the homeless population. L.A., San Diego, Fresno, Richmond, Laguna Beach, they've all eliminated their nighttime sleeping bans. Santa Cruz, you pass harsher laws and pays two city attorneys to waste still more money. This is a shameful attempt to bully two penniless poor people for insisting on their right to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. The council is hopeless on this issue. I invite the community to come down 10 a.m. Friday, May 29th, to Department 4 at 701 Ocean Street to support these two people, to watch where your money is going, and to join us in future protests. I want you to notice that I'm probably the last speaker, the next to the last speaker. There's a lot of oral communications time left that is not being used. Mayor Matthews is insisting on limiting us to 2 minutes each. This is hardly fair to the public or to the community that wants to hear us. Thank you.
And again, I remind you that tomorrow at 10 o'clock, might well be worth your while if you're interested in civil rights for homeless people and those issues to come on down to Department 4. That's at 701 Ocean, where the courts are in the flat court building next to the 5-story county building. And we're going to be trying to provide some coffee outside for people who want to show up early. I'm going to try to show up around 9:45 with some maybe some cocoa or some coffee for folks, and to come in and in a show of actually this support for not only for these two people who you may not know, Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon, but for the idea that to spend city money to criminalize people who simply want to sleep at night and have no place to go, which is the situation in Santa Cruz for 95% of the homeless community tonight, tomorrow night, night after, and so forth. This is not going to be helped by criminalizing two people, and in fact, it's a kind of a form of, I don't know, what would you call it, mellow terrorism, friendly fascism. I don't want to use those terms because it's pretty outright outrageous to tell someone they can't sleep legally, period, at night if they're homeless. It's just wrong. And the city knows it. Other cities have known it. But they prefer to avoid the issue because their feet aren't held to the fire. So when the feet start getting held to the fire, things are going to change. I actually have here two declarations from two witnesses who are going to be, well, their declarations will be presented tomorrow, and they may be testifying. I'm not sure if they're actually going to be in court. They may be. One of them is Paul Lee, who I've had a lot of negative things to say about Paul, but I've got to say some positive things, too. Paul Lee is an author. He's a philanthropist. He helped found the Citizens Committee for the Homeless in the 80s. He's a teacher, I believe, or at least he throws educational shindigs of different kinds, ranging from I think he was involved with Penny University when Paige Smith was alive. He's written a book, The Quality of Mercy, which has his own particular take on the homeless situation in Santa Cruz. I'm one of the chief demons in the book, but that's neither here nor there. That's his perspective. And, you know, he has actually been helpful in setting up the first cold and rainy night shelter when Jane Immler was protesting in 1985. A lot of positive things to say about Paul Lee. He tried to support the Camp Paradise homeless encampment of the early years of this millennium. It was 2001, I guess, 2002, with the Santa Cruz Service Corps, which was a kind of a work program that he tried to get going in concert with Larry Templeton's Camp Paradise. So Paul has, over the years, tried to do various things. I think he was involved in trying to set up an eco-village. Anyway, here's his declaration. I, Paul A. Lee, do hereby declare, I possess personal knowledge of all the following facts based on my experience set forth herein. If called as a witness, I would testify truthfully to the following. 1. I've been an advocate for the homeless in Santa Cruz County for the past 24 years. 2. 24 years ago, I, along with a colleague, opened the first homeless shelter in Santa Cruz. That's the Cedar Street Cold and Rainy Night Shelter. I founded the Homeless Garden Project, the Homeless Services Center on River Street, and several other homeless facilities in Santa Cruz, including the Paul Lee Loft Shelter. That may be pushing things a little far to say he founded them, but he certainly has been involved in these issues. I've authored the book, The Quality of Mercy, which chronicles the development of homeless services in Santa Cruz from 1985 to 1992. I have attached a CV to this declaration as Exhibit A. I'm not quite sure what a CV is, but who knows? If you come tomorrow to court, maybe you'll find out. Applied Survey Research's 2007 Santa Cruz County Homeless Census and Survey is the most recent comprehensive survey of homeless issues in Santa Cruz. A similar study was conducted for this year, however, it's not been made publicly available. This survey has been attached to this declaration as Exhibit B. These studies are considered highly reliable by the County of Santa Cruz. The statistics are commissioned by and utilized by the County of Santa Cruz in determining their provision of services to homeless persons. In 2007, the survey referenced above found that over the course of a year, an estimated 5,595 people were homeless in Santa Cruz County. Actually, I think it's significantly higher, but let's just grant that. Total number of homeless persons in any one day was found to be 2,789. I have spent over 24 years providing services and programming to homeless persons in Santa Cruz County. I'm aware of all the programs and facilities currently available, including their occupancy limits. In Santa Cruz County, and here we're getting to the nub of it, between the dates of November 15th and March 15th, there are beds available to single homeless persons in Santa Cruz County. These beds break down as follows. 100 at the De La Viega Armory, 14 at the Interfaith Satellite Shelter, 46 at the Homeless Service Center's Paul Lee Loft, 32 at the River Street Shelter, and those are on a waiting list, as is the Pauley Loft, I add for your benefit. It's not in his declaration. 30 Pajaro Rescue Mission, located in Pajaro down near Watsonville. The Rebelly program is for families only, with 28 families. There are 51 in the Salvation Army in Watsonville. That means that in the winter, Santa Cruz has the capacity to house 301, or 10.8% of the homeless persons in Santa Cruz County, at maximum capacity. Between the dates of March 15th and November 15th, that's where we are now, essentially spring, summer, and fall, the armory is closed and other shelters have less space. At these times, there are a total of beds in Santa Cruz County available to all homeless persons at 188. This means that between March 15th and November 15th, Santa Cruz County can only house a maximum of 6.7% of its homeless population. Of the shelters named in the item above, only the De La Vega Armory, the Paul Lee Loft, the River Street Shelter are open to single adult homeless persons in the North County. This is a total of 192 when the armory is open and 92 when the armory is closed. And I would say it's even less because if you want to walk into a shelter, Paul Lee Loft and the River Street Shelter are on a waiting list basis. So the only thing that's really open is the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which has... I'm a little bit murky about this. I think it is... like 20 to 40 beds at most in the spring, summer, and fall. The 2007 survey determined that 34% of homeless persons reported sleeping outside. Over 20% of survey recipients stated that they tried to access emergency shelter or transitional housing facility within Santa Cruz County in the 30 days prior to the survey, but were turned away. Of those who were turned away, a lack of available beds was cited as the number one reason for being denied admittance to the shelter. Based on the most recent survey attached here too, based on my expertise developed over the past 23 years, and based on my knowledge of the available facilities and programs in the area, it is my opinion that Santa Cruz does not have sufficient shelter space for shelters to be a viable option for the majority of homeless persons on any one night. This is particularly true when the De La Vega Armory is closed, like tonight. Depending on the time of year, Santa Cruz County does not provide either 89.2% or 93.3% of homeless persons with indoor shelter options. Therefore, it is my opinion that sleeping outside for the vast majority of homeless persons in Santa Cruz County is not a volitional act, that is to say, one you can will, one you can say yes or no to, but instead a product of a severe shortage of resources directed to housing the homeless population in Santa Cruz County. Finally, as a resident of Santa Cruz for 43 years, considering the lack of available resources, I do not believe that the acts complained of against Anna and Miguel, that they're going to be going to court for tomorrow, namely sleeping in public, sitting on the sidewalk, possessing sleeping materials and other personal items, and other issues related to being homeless, can constitute a public nuisance, but instead constitute the mere means to survive. Criminalizing sleeping logically implies that shelter space must be available. Otherwise, the population that has no shelter is made criminal by their mere peaceful existence, inasmuch as sleeping is a necessary function of life. I find enforcement of the sleeping ban I suspect he's going to tell us he finds it abusive or illegal or unconstitutional, all words that I've used to describe the sleeping ban. And my apologies to Paul for not having the last page of his declaration available, but you will be able to hear this case argued if you want to go to court tomorrow, 10 a.m., Department 4, and I encourage you to do so. Attorney Jonathan Gettleman and Mark Briscoe, attorneys Briscoe and Gettleman, will be arguing the case for both these people. They are not being paid. They are doing so pro bono. One of the sort of ruthless strategies of the Barrisonis, the city attorneys, is to use a remedy here, as if they would call it a remedy, to use a lawsuit that is a civil lawsuit but has criminal consequences. So they're trying to say, you're guilty of being a public nuisance and so we want the judge to order you not to sleep at night. Which sounds ridiculous, but, you know, that's what they want. Maybe they'll order them not to sleep at night downtown, but it's illegal everywhere in the city. So wherever they sleep, it's going to be illegal. But the idea is that they're not even getting attorneys to defend them, even though they risk jail if they are found to be, you know, in violation, if this injunction is granted and they're found to be in violation of it. There's also a declaration by Paul Brindell. Paul has been all kinds of things. He's the program director of the Shelter Project, the Community Action Board. He's run it since 1983. It involves getting emergency shelter for people released from the hospital with no place to recover, emergency rent and mortgage assistance, voicemail system for the homeless, which is one of the, I think, his biggest accomplishments. And he also testifies about the lack of shelter and the lack of shelter beds. And he was on, he notes he was on the task force, the Homeless Issues Task Force, which he falsely says has 8 people. It had 12, but can't get everything right, I guess. He essentially says that there's only shelter beds for people with specialized needs, not for homeless people generally. He points out that back in 2000, this task force, which I've talked about and whose report is online, it's called the Homeless Issues Task Force, and you can find it by Googling for Santa Cruz Homeless Issues Task Force, got some interesting recommendations. It was the city council's attempt to divert activism, but the activists who got involved in it were quite clear. It was ironic. It was a strange situation where even merchants from the Downtown Association agreed the camping ordinance had to be repealed, that it was pointless. They've gotten worse since then. Now they're trying to put into play even worse laws with under the illusion that you can scare people into getting out of town, hiding out or getting out, as I described Mike Rutkin's solution to sleeping is. And Paul Brindell, in his recommendation, in his declaration, says he reminds us that the Homeless Issues Task Force said repeal the camping ordinance. This is a group of people appointed by the Santa Cruz City Council. It's not a bunch of radicals, not a bunch of homeless people. In fact, there were only 2 homeless people in the group of 12 that were on this Homeless Issues Task Force. It made recommendations to mitigate and alleviate the large numbers of unsheltered homeless persons. They included expanding the use of the armory, which wasn't done, and they were all supported unanimously, but there's insufficient legal and adequate shelter space, according to Brindell, and he's quite correct. And he says, it is my opinion that sleeping outdoors and engaging in other acts relating to homelessness, possession of a large amount of personal items, sleeping near food and services, are not nuisance behavior under the circumstances, but are instead necessary acts of survival where homeless persons face insufficient resources, services, and particularly shelter space. And Paul Brindell signs that under penalty of perjury. And that's, again, coming up tomorrow, Department for Judge Burdick in the case of Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon, in a case that has, I think, broad significance, and I encourage people to come to that. I'll be there. We can all chat about it. Let's hear some more of the city council meeting, and then, of course, or at any point, you can call in at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. I'm at Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Mike, that's your warning, please.
Just a note, the people...
Let me note here something else. Here you have the mayor, Cynthia Matthews, warning Michael Tomasi, who is kind of the council clown. Much as I like Michael in many respects, he's full of contradictory and sometimes nonsensical and often repetitive speechifying that he makes at city council. He's an old vet who, or that's what he says, and I believe him, who stands up and says, I love you, wants to do the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, has been homeless, and may be homeless now as far as I know, has suffered a number of indignities from the police department, but he's one of the few people who either applauds, doesn't boo, he applauds. I think it's quite appropriate to either boo or applaud at city council, depending on how you feel about what they're doing, provided it doesn't disrupt the assembly. You know, Brad, you stop after a certain point and allow the council to continue its business. After all, it's supposed to be a legislative body open to the community, not some sort of high religious group that issues edicts that we all have to get down on our knees and thank them for. But
that unfortunately seems to be what happens. Or we criticize them, you know, in little voices outside city council, but feel like we have to behave with the utmost propriety in city council, lest we be arrested or harassed or censured or evicted. And that's a case actually that's coming up for me on June 12th, when I was told to leave the council because after the mayor at that time had told a member of the public, threatened her with arrest inappropriately, I raised my arm in a silent, "You're acting like a bunch of Nazis" salute. And that case is going to be going to federal court on June 12th up in San Francisco. We have a caller. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hey, it's Dave.
Hey there. Are we talking about Drummer Dave?
Yeah, and you know, that city council, man, they need to pull their pants down. You know, I mean, I've had it with them, man. They're trying to pull this stuff on people, man. They need to pull their pants down, Rob. That's all I got to say.
They want to pants the city council? My, my.
They need to pull their pants down and show us.
I see.
Make us come in there and pull our pants down so we can show them.
Hmm.
You know, they better pull their pants down when I get in there tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
Well, you're not going to be, of course, talking to the city council. That'll be the court, and you'll probably get a contempt citation.
The judge, but I mean the city council. No, they need to pull their pants down and show us their stuff because, hey.
I don't know if I want to see their stuff, actually, but I hear you, Dave.
Well, I'm talking about all their money laundering and all their homeless people squanderings. They better get it together.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Hey, and Rob, you take it easy, and I love your show, man.
Thank you, man. Yeah, and I can't speak to the money laundering. I can say that squandering money on golf courses and huge amounts of money on over-policing the downtown area, pandering to developers, non-union developers like Barry Swenson, these are all of their consequences. And when you hit an economic hard time, the consequences become really apparent. Of course, the city council screams, that's all the more reason to give in to Barry's latest La Bahia project and so forth, whatever the complaints of the neighbors may be and whatever the consequences of the community may be. Anyway, here's some more from the Santa Cruz City Council of last Tuesday. Actually, I think we're in the middle of my speech here at oral communication. This is on items not on the council agenda.
Being prosecuted,
Ryan Coonerty,
who don't show up to court. So it's not that they didn't pay their tickets. It's not that they didn't. It's not the crime. It's that they don't even bother to show decency to show up to court and to get community service or argue their point or do anything else. They just ignore the warning after warning after warning. 60
What you're hearing here is a Ryan Coonerty defending this action that is coming up in court tomorrow against these two homeless musicians, Richardson and DeLeon. The idea that you somehow have to show up in court to justify your right to sleep is ridiculous. The police should be asked to show up in court to justify their violation of the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment against homeless people when they have no alternatives. But, of course, Ryan Coonerty, who's a constitutional lawyer and teaches law at Cabrillo and at Santa Cruz UCSC, should know this. But unfortunately, he also owns or is part of a family that owns a big business downtown, the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which has for years been a leader in the Downtown Association's criminalization of the poor downtown. It's kind of strange because the Coonerty family is also quite compassionate on an individual level toward homeless people, for example. You find them sleeping in the eaves of the Bookshop Santa Cruz sometimes. The Coonerty Bookshop is to be commended for keeping its bathrooms open to the community. I always have to say this, not just because, you know, I want to be accurate, but, well, I guess that's really the reason. I don't feel a lot of love for the Coonertys for doing this, even though I think it's a positive community service that they do this. And the reason I don't feel a lot of love for them is because of what else they do. You know, because of the other kinds of anti-homeless measures that they have supported. That's father and son, Neil Coonerty, the supervisor, Ryan Coonerty, former mayor and now city council member, the guy you just heard speaking, defending this outrageous injunction against these two. I guess his notion is that every time they get a ticket, they should troop into court, not stand in food lines, not try to do what they're doing as homeless people to survive, but go to court to act as though this is a legitimate charge against them, sleeping outside, when they have no choice, when the city's own experts have certified there are no legal places for the overwhelming majority of homeless people. I mean, it's like Alice in Wonderland, but then again, if you look at Obama expanding the war in Pakistan and creating 2 million refugees, I guess we should be happy they're not bombing the homeless here in Santa Cruz.
The other voice, that of Mike Rodkin.
Mayor.
And that was 30 minutes, actually more like 10 minutes of oral communication. Cynthia Matthews pretending to allow 30 minutes, but cutting people back to 2 minutes each, which she's done ever since she's become mayor. I think on one occasion she got expansive and allowed people 3 minutes. When I first began speaking before City Council in 1988, people were allowed much broader amounts of time, and that has become increasingly restricted, even though the City Council actually spends less time in session now than it did then. In fact, it only spends, it only spent an afternoon session in May, and it seems they're just really eager to rush home and not hear the public at all. Before the council met, there was an earlier meeting of what's called the closed session of City Council, which I'll now talk about.
And actually, I did talk about that. I prepared this tape beforehand, some of it, so that's what happened. This is where I gave my claim against the city for the Metro false arrest. And for those who are interested, I mentioned how outrageously the judge has demanded that we provide them with a written transcript of the tape that documents how abusive and absurd are the charges of the security guards and the police who were trying to remove me from the property because essentially I was challenging their authority. I mean, if somebody's interfering with police business in some meaningful way, then you've got some right to step in, I suppose, as a police officer. But if you don't like the fact that somebody is telling you, you know, I don't like something you're doing, the proper response is to say, okay, this is my badge number, it's my superior's name, take it up with them. That's the way to do it. You don't order them off the property. And that's an attempt to punish people for trying to get more information and trying to complain about what is essentially rude and possibly illegal behavior. By illegal behavior, I was talking about is not really the behavior of the security guards, although the security guards apparently have broader powers than police officers in terms of you have less rights. Police are supposed to inform you, you know, you're under arrest. If you're under arrest, they're supposed to advise you that you don't have to speak without an attorney present. They're not supposed to search you without your consent unless you are under arrest. Security guards, you know, are in a position where they claim to have a lot of broader powers. Actually, I'm not really entirely clear as to what their powers are, but I was pretty damn clear that they had no right to order me out of a public facility when I'd done absolutely nothing other than demand their name and badge number for not essentially noting that for not dealing with the issue of religious sermons coming over the loudspeakers on public money violating the First Amendment. Be free from an establishment of religion. The government is not supposed to fund religious sermons, particularly fundamentalist sermons, coming over the loudspeakers of the Metro Transit Authority. And that seems to be what was going on. I'm going to try to post online the transcript. It is a long transcript. It's 48 pages long. It apparently costs hundreds of dollars to transcribe. The judge is, I think, trying to punish the defense. The judge is Judge Ariadne Simons, who is a former district attorney. I've talked about her conduct in the trial, which I find abusive of the defense and biased toward the prosecution. But we got her transcript, and we'll hopefully be providing it for the community to read, too, perhaps on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, the same site where you can read about the Jax controversy at Santa Cruz Indie Media, if you want to find that out. And again, call-in number here if you want to call in with questions, comments, or your own stories is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. Off-air number if you have other comments you don't want to make publicly, or perhaps you just have some questions you don't think are really relevant to the radio show, but maybe I can help you with. The number is 423-4833, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. HUFF is the organization I work with. We meet every Wednesday, 9:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe in the morning, in case you want to come on down. You can volunteer to help us without coming down. That rarely happens, but I'd love to see it happen more. And so give a call if you want, 423-HUFF. Some of the projects that we're working on involve things like these situations where homeless people are complaining that restaurants are discriminating against them because of their status as being homeless people, because they don't like them hanging out nearby, because they're being pressured by their neighbors for whatever reasons. Again, in the case of Jack's, Connie, the owner, disputes this. She claims it's because of behavior problems by specific people. I wasn't present when all these things happened. I get stories from both sides. My concern is to see a procedure by which it's worked out to the satisfaction of both sides, but most particularly to the satisfaction of homeless people whose rights are, in my mind, and I think in reality, being trampled upon every day by this community, mostly by the police, by authorities, and by the Downtown Association. That's the struggle that we're in. That's the struggle I've been in for the last 20 years in this community, and I hope you join it. And I hope you join it on the right side. In any case, here's some more from the Tuesday City Council meeting.
Next up is the consent agenda. And this is an interesting situation. This is the agenda that has most of the substantive items of the City Council's business on it. Hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars are appropriated here, all in one vote, unless a member of the City Council, and it used to be a member of the public, removes that item from the agenda for general discussion, in which case there'll be an individual vote on that item and the opportunity to hear from the public. When Ryan Coonerty was mayor, he changed that rule, and Cynthia Matthews has continued the change, so that you can only speak on an item if a council member pulls the item for you to talk about. Now, lest you think that this is a violation of the law, state law, the Brown Act, which says that that members of the public can talk on every item, the City Council has provided itself an escape hatch by giving a brief two-minute period before all the items, that is to say, before the entire block of usually anywhere from 10 to 25 items, in which you can either spend your time trying to persuade the council to take the item off the agenda specifically to be discussed and voted on separately, or you can talk about perhaps one or two of those items, as many as you can fit in a two-minute period. The point here is that the oral communication period that comes before this, if you speak at the oral communications period, you're not allowed to talk on items that are on the agenda. So you can't talk on items on the consent agenda, of which there are many. Usually, as I said, 15 to 25. The only time you have... And I believe I have a bit of commentary on that issue.
However, let's see. I think the commentary... commentary is going to have to wait because we're going to roll forward on this issue. Again, I always bring up the consent agenda because even though, you know... Even if they return to the process prior to 2008 when Ryan Coonerty became mayor, actually you have to really go back to 2005 when Rotkin was mayor, and he sharply limited the time allowed on consent agenda items, but at least he didn't attempt to give you to deny you the right to remove a consent agenda item. This was a radical move by Coonerty to essentially disenfranchise, I guess, that part of the public that he felt wasn't worth listening to anyway, or to severely limit its time. Even if we go back before that time, you know, you would find that the public is severely disadvantaged if it wants to really discuss items at coming up to City Council. You really have to be kind of a palsy-walsy with a council member. They don't work in committees in the same way that, let's say, Congress does, although I'm not in any way suggesting that the public has much sway with Congress, which is a major plutocracy and has little to do with democracy. Plutocracy, of course, is ruled by the wealthy, ruled by wealth. But in Santa Cruz, at a local level, you know, the enemy, so to speak, is among us. I mean, council members have to live in Santa Cruz, and they do. Council members, to some extent, you see them on the streets of Santa Cruz. You can go up to them and try to talk to them. Lynn Robinson has never returned a phone call in her life to me, but, you know, she once paraded around as a woman of the people who would respond to concerns by the community. She was very friendly before she was elected, and then when she was elected, wham, bam, that was it. The doors came down. But the fact of the matter is, it's always been hard to have any kind of access to city council because of their procedures. Members of the public can't put items on the agenda themselves, as they can in some cities. You can, if you get, 4,000 signatures, you can have an initiative. But that's really hard to do. It takes a lot of organizing, and a lot of people have to be involved. And a lot of money is often involved there. And it has been nearly done. I mean, there's another kind of a similar process called the referendum that is usable in Santa Cruz, whereby the city council does something and you want to overturn it, within 30 days you have to gather a huge number of signatures. And that was done in the case where Rotkin and Matthews and Kennedy destroyed rent control at De Anza Mobile Home Park. And the De Anza people got together and actually got enough signatures to create a referendum, but then were talked out of it by the inner circle of the De Anza, I guess it's the elders at De Anza who were able to, who stopped that process, I guess for fear they would be punished by the city council. I think it was ridiculous. They had a real chance to keep rent control in place. The city council was essentially surrendering to MHC, a large corporation that was suing them. That was back in 2002, 2003. And then they did the same thing with the Clearview Court, the other mobile home park that had rent control. They sold them out. These are not liberals, folks. These are not progressives on city council on local issues. They like to wear the mask. They like to parade around at election time doing that, but they are not by any means in any way, in any meaningful sense, progressive on homeless issues, on issues of community control of police, on issues of rent control. It ain't happening. And they've got all kinds of excuses for it, but they don't do it.
Here now is the consent agenda with me rising to try to remove two items. One, to talk about one of the items, like a 7A, where I made a claim against the city for this Metro Transit matter, a false arrest there, which I've talked about elsewhere. And the second one having to do with the enhanced safety zones, the fines, triple fines for violating a number of ordinances during the 4th of July, which I try to get the city council to let me talk about.
So with that, we'll move on to consent agenda, and this is a time when we... did you have oral communications? Okay. This is a time when we act on a series of agenda items in one motion, basically approving the staff recommendation unless the item is pulled for discussion by a council member.
And it should be said that you may remember Cynthia Matthews interrupted herself to say, "Do you have oral communications?" And the only reason she did that was because the person who was standing at the side of the room requesting, or who appeared to be waiting to speak, was Micah Posner of People Power, who has a certain cachet, a certain pull, a certain respectability before the city council, though he and they don't always agree. And I've been a supporter of his on a number of matters. He is a supporter of mine. But he is considered to be a respectable bike advocate, at least by a number of people on the council. So anybody else standing by the side who was there, Matthews would never have interrupted herself and said, "Do you have oral communications?" That would be my judgment. Because she knows this person, she did. And I find that a typical example of the kind of favoritism that she shows almost unconsciously at city council meetings.
Give an opportunity for members of the public to comment briefly, either commenting or asking that an item be pulled. I'm going to start by asking if there are items that the council member wants to have pulled. Catherine?
Yes, I'd like to pull 13. Okay. And take routes to school.
Okay. Anyone else, Don?
Number 8.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, 8 and 13 have been pulled. So I'll entertain a motion at that point.
And suddenly she's about to proceed without allowing the public to speak until Rotkin interrupts her to remind her that, yes, the public is out there, and, you know, I know we're not going to really let them talk much, but you have to allow that opportunity or you're violating the law.
This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak briefly, up to 2 minutes, on a consent agenda item.
Pardon me, Mayor Matthews.
Yes.
Are you going to continue 7A?
City Attorney John Barisoni.
Yes, thank you. I overlooked that. Item 7A in closed session, we recommended to continue, so that would be included in the consent agenda recommendation.
7A is the Norris item?
That's you.
Thank you. Well, I'm only interested in one item, item 11. I'm requesting you pull it. This is the item that involves more overtime bucks for the cops and more citations for the community, or if you want to put it differently, it's a special safety enhancement zone for July 4th. I see you have about 20 items shoehorned onto the consent agenda for this afternoon, no evening session, and, of course, very limited time to speak during all communications. This effectively removes any meaningful public comment unless one of the council members here actually wants to restore the democratic process to return Santa Cruz to the community of cities that allows its members to comment on items individually when a member of the public wants to pull an item. I recall at least three of the council members who are running came up and said at a forum that they were interested in expanding public comment. I've seen no evidence of this yet. I'd like to see it if possible. It's traditionally been the Santa Cruz way, and I would ask Council Members Lane and Madrigal, if you were here, and Byers to fulfill their campaign promises and resume the traditional practice of allowing the public to speak, not having to beg and grovel and ask a council member to pull an item. Since there's no evening session, everything is crammed into the afternoon agenda. This avoids unnecessary input from the public, or is it the unnecessary public? I hope you'll give me the 2 minutes to speak on the item number 11, because I think it's a significant item. You don't have a budget clearly itemized for how much overtime is likely to be spent. You have no indication from the police as to how many citations were issued last year, the year before, during the July 4th era. And it was during this particular period, I've got more to say about it, that there was massive complaints from the public throughout the county the way the police agencies, both city and county, were behaving toward the community.
Your time is up.
Yeah. Thank you.
And in case people don't know what this is, it's a little obscure, the city council has taken to creating what's called triple fine zones, which mean that during a certain period of time, whether it's New Year's Eve or 4th of July or Halloween, those are the three traditional times when they've been doing it, fines are tripled in a number of areas for fireworks, for what's called conduct on public property, open container, for discharging a firearm, which, you know, doesn't happen much. Some of these other things happen a lot. I mean, people have open containers. People do have fireworks. And the idea is to intimidate people, or as Mike Rotkin likes to say, to deter them from doing that. And that's what the discussion is about, whether there should be a triple fines and how much this really costs the city in terms of police overtime, in terms of checking. Because it's not only that they've said, okay, they're going to be triple fines, but they also appropriate a significant amount of police to run around patrolling and checking and maybe making a little extra money for the city with these triple fines. I guess maybe it's a money-making enterprise. Maybe it's a way of dealing with the budget crisis. I don't know. I don't like the idea, and I wanted to talk about it. And to my incredible surprise, for the first time, Mike Rotkin actually allowed me to talk about it, but you know, that really wasn't the point. The point, of course, is to change the whole system so that anybody can come to city council meeting, as they have been in the past, and be able to talk about this stuff without having to get the permission of my daddy on the city council. Right?
Brian.
Wait. Are you speaking about another item on the consent agenda? Okay.
speak later on item 13, where I think that Public Works hasn't done a great procedural job, but I saw item 12 on this agenda. I just want to appreciate them. This is a really great project, the Highway 1 bike pedestrian underpass project, and I think Public Works, especially Chris, has worked really hard to bring it to fruition. It was a very difficult bureaucracy with Caltrans and other agencies, and I'm just really excited to see that it's going out to bid, and just want to appreciate Public Works for their efforts on it.
Thanks.
Okay, Ryan and Mike.
I want to move the consent agenda with the exception of item number 13 and continuing 7A.
And 8.
I want to pull number 11.
Eight.
I'm pulling number 11.
Okay. So, the motion, is that okay with you, Ryan?
Well, what's happening here is that Mike Rotkin is pulling the item I requested to be pulled. And they're voting the rest of the consent agenda through. Except for another item that was also pulled.
8, 11, and 13, and a change.
Continue item number 7, 8 till next regular meeting.
Till future notice. Yeah.
Item number 7, 8, again, and another. Sorry about the microphone situation. Item 7, 8, and a very unusual situation for me is the claim I have against the city for the Metro Transit Authority and the false arrest which the two police officers colluded with the security guard in doing down there last November. And it's very unusual because usually all my claims are routinely denied without any kind of discussion. In this case, the claim was not accepted, but it was not denied. It was continued. And as I may have mentioned before, I think they're waiting for the verdict of Judge Simons on this issue, which will come out on June 9th for those who are interested. This is the case, again, of the talking at the Metro as a reporter investigating homeless stuff, discrimination there, and being told to leave as a consequence and then saying, no, I don't want to leave. I'm in right to be in a public place.
Okay. Any other comment? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? That carries unanimously. So we'll go first again for initiating it. We'll move on to item number 11, excuse me, which was pulled by Mike. And that is the safety enhancement zone. Police is the lead.
So here, make a just very brief description of what's being proposed.
Did you want to say why you pulled it? Or?
No. I'd like to give, I pull it because I want to give a member of the public two more minutes to make his argument. Take it seriously and then...
Bravo, Mike. I can hear Zach Friend, the police
driver, so enjoy it. Zach Friend, police. This is the exact same staff report. In fact, to prove it to you, all I did was change the year on it from last year. So there's absolutely no change from what you've approved in previous years. The locations are the same. The ordinances that it covers are the exact same, except for this year it actually added in fireworks.
It's strange that Zach would brag about it being the same report as last year because it's a new year. I mean, we want to talk about the experience of the previous year. I guess he feels that he doesn't need to say a damn thing because the city council is going to rubber stamp it, which, of course, is an accurate perception.
Which was something that came before you a few months ago.
And the purpose for this is...
And before he goes into the purpose of it, notice that there's obviously been no attempt to indicate how successful this was the past year, how much it cost, whether there were any problems. It's a carbon copy of the previous request in 2008 with the clear expectation that the council is going to rubber stamp it, which, of course, it does.
Right in 2006, really mostly as a deterrent for people to not commit certain crimes during certain times of the year, but we have a high number of nuisance crimes, specifically littering, urinating in public, or in this case, fireworks and discharge of firearms. So it just creates a safety enhancement zone for us, triple fines, which are usually actually not enforced to very high numbers. In fact, the numbers aren't generally a whole lot more as far as citations go than they are on any other day.
So it's primarily deterrent against
the main point is deterrent, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your
question.
And that's Catherine Byers, who's going to ask a question. I found it a little hard to read how large these zones were, but notice that Zach Friend presents no stats. I mean, again, I guess I've said this before, but I'm emphasizing he doesn't even feel a need to justify in any way what's being done with any particular kind of documentation because he knows he's dealing with a chorus of the faithful, and they're going to hallelujah him, or, you know, if he unless he comes in, you know, buck naked, riding a camel, I don't think you're going to find anything out of the ordinary and require any kind of documentation.
I don't even think I was in town last year. It looks like the streets close at 7 p.m. I think that's what this is saying, those major streets. Am I correct?
I actually don't have the resolution.
7 p.m. to midnight?
Mm-hmm.
Several streets will be closed 7 p.m. to midnight on July 4th. I guess that strikes me as a strange time. Traffic must be just awful.
Well, actually, that's
it's
the
time. It's on a Saturday. It's on a weekend, too, as well, this year. So.
Right. Well, at that time, actually, it's not just that there's street closures. Actually, there's rerouting. If you notice that there's rerouting specifically to improve traffic flow. But what we do is it's on the map.
Okay.
It's a little unclear as to how rerouting and having fewer streets can improve the flow of traffic. I mean, this is typical Zach Friend doublespeak. I didn't comment on it when my turn did come to speak. And as I said, this is the only occasion where Rotkin or any other council member has actually put aside time for me to be able to speak on an item at City Council on the consent agenda that I remember.
It's specifically in an area that we find that tends to have the highest fireworks activity in that area, and what we're trying to do is route people through the beach that tend to go down the boardwalk and stuff in a more efficient manner than not. Do you see the map rerouting?
Yeah.
Again, a more efficient manner with fewer streets and fewer access roads.
Did it work last year?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty... sometimes it can take up to 2 hours to get from Ocean Street to 17 in that situation, but, I mean, I would rather have police controlling the flow of cars than none.
And again, he didn't really answer the question. Did it work last year? In essence, he did. No, it didn't. It took 2 hours. But by having police on the streets, we get to pay extra for that, of course, you somehow did a better job of traffic than citizens controlling their own traffic or using the normal signal lights and side streets. You know, I'm sure I may be missing something here, but it sounds strange. It wasn't really the reason that I pulled it off the agenda, but it shows you just how little the police have to defend what sounds like poppycock.
Of course, Zach would prefer the police do this. I mean, it's nice to have a job, isn't it?
At all. Yeah. Trying to understand it. Thank you.
All relative, unfortunately.
It is.
Lynn? Just in terms of the...
Councilmember Lynn Robinson rushes in, of course, to defend the police.
Area where it just is like one thing, it's like a war zone down there. The other thing it's doing is actually giving a lot more ability to for folks that are trying to hide the fireworks down, you know, in advance and stuff. So it's been a huge issue for the neighbors. The reports that I got back, it, you know, because they do have the access points, and it's already been tried out at least 1 year for that area in terms of that safety zone area for access to the residences.
No, that's been since we initiated this in 2006.
It's been two cycles.
It sounds like what Lynn Robinson is saying, although she's not saying it too clearly, and maybe I misunderstand her, is it gives the police an opportunity to keep an eye on whether fireworks are being transported so they can observe it. I mean, that would be, I suppose, one possible reason for requiring people to take certain streets if they were driving. Again, it's not clear to me exactly what she's saying, but, well, you be the judge.
And also the Lynn Robinson's vague statements about reports is kind of reminiscent of her behind-the-scenes activities in not documenting but pushing forward proposals to massively increase policing downtown, supporting Coonerty's parking lot panic law and parking garage paranoia laws that were passed in the last few years. Her casual statements about it being a war zone down there, I'm not quite sure what she means by that. I don't want to suggest it's a racist dismissal of the beach flats, maybe she's talking about, you know, a lot of traffic during 4th of July and the beaches. It's just, a number of questions come up in my mind, that's all.
Effective from everything that I've heard, and I think what Zach's been actually able to show is that it's much more of a deterrent, which is the goal here, than being punitive. It's only punitive to the people that aren't willing to respond to what we're putting in effect. So.
And again, what that means, of course, is on the 4th of July, people who actually do engage in firework activity will be penalized. And it's obviously punitive. That's Independence Day, which I talk about in a moment. The idea that this little band of council members and their cops can run around controlling people on Independence Day and not allow the community to control itself, except for with such trivial violations as sitting on the sidewalk or sitting on a planter, which is one of the triple fine zone deals, or littering. It's an attempt to substitute fear for festivity. And indeed, that was one of the major complaints of last year.
Okay. If there are no other questions, I'll invite public comment.
I want to apologize for the humming noise, but it's not really my fault. The humming noise comes directly off the video of the city council, and it's a strange kind of... I've been getting tapes from the city council recently, for example, with the downtown commission hearings, which I've tried to get. The city council is supposed to keep a copy of the hearing so members of the public can hear it who can't go to it. And some of them are so badly covered with hums and buzzes that you can't really play them on the air. You can distinguish it if you work hard or if you're listening attentively to the tape yourself. But it's hard. I've played a couple of these on the air in the past, and they're just really horrible. And when you bring that to the attention of the staff, they say, "Oh well, it's bad equipment." They apparently don't mind spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on consultants, but they don't want you to have an accurate hearing on what they're doing in these commissions, committees, and even at city council itself. It could be that this is a problem with my equipment in this situation, but even my little tape recorder records better than this kind of horrible sound that's coming over. I'll let that one pass because I'm not playing the direct tape. I'm playing a recording of the tape.
Fair opportunity, and I want to thank Councilmember Rotkin, but really it shouldn't be dependent upon the favor or the whim of a particular council member, but thank you anyway. Citizens can control traffic. I saw it done on Mission Street, and Micah Posner didn't even get any citations from the police department for doing it. That was about two or three Sundays ago. The Sentinel's website, if you look at it, reveals the massive overtime being given to the police officers, many of them for, I regard, probably much of it as downtown overtime on the secret Robinson Matthews Coonerty downtown working group, or whatever you call it, that the public is not invited to, but the merchants are, that has resulted in a massive harassment of poor and homeless people downtown. But there's a cost to this thing, and the cost is not mentioned in the agenda report. And that's interesting. I mean, why not? You're way concerned about the budget, but there's no cost estimates. What was the cost last year? How many citations were issued? What kind of complaints were received? You don't get any of this information from a police compliance staff. It's not a healthy way to run a city council or a city on this issue. It was so controversial in some respects when Councilmember Madrigal brought up a possible racial profiling issue. Every single one of you gave the police additional time and denounced him, even though San Jose has a massive racial profiling problem.
And it may sound like I'm kind of going off on a riff here, but in fact, the whole brouhaha about Councilmember Madrigal's noting possible racial profiling had to do and came up during a time when they were discussing triple fine zones for Halloween. And the idea being that if you're going to have this huge increase in penalties, you need to make sure that the whole thing is being evenly administered. And there was some concern among some members of the community that that wasn't happening. The result of the city council was not to independently investigate this or, look at the issue somewhat dispassionately, but to just jump on board a kick Madrigal line, throw a pie at the Tony Madrigal, which resulted in a lot of people on the left saying, "Oh, wow, that Tony Madrigal, what a great guy he is."
when in fact, you know, he's done very, very little to do anything about police misconduct, either when he was on police review board or while he was on city council. However, the kind of response of the city council to this issue shows how, I mean, I've already used the word hopeless in terms of how they are dealing with any kind of attempt to discuss dispassionately whether more money needs to be shoveled into the police station and more police need to be thrown out on the streets to give out more tickets or make people feel they're threatened with more tickets in order to get people to behave in the ways that Cynthia Matthews, Lynn Robinson, and Ryan Coonerty want them to behave.
And we see here the use of resisting arrest charges and drunken public charges to target a particular economic class in Santa Cruz. So that's the class I'm concerned about being targeted here. Whenever you bring out the police, I think it not only can be a deterrent, on occasion it is, but it can also be a provocation, particularly when people are trying to celebrate the 4th of July, Independence Day, the day when authority is overthrown and the British were kicked out. They want to see a lot of cops running around with badges and guns directing them where to go. That's not what I saw in the Sentinel last year, even in the Sentinel,
your
when this issue
is
was raised. And thank you for my time.
Sure, if you want to comment, this is your time.
Yeah, I'm not speaking as for people power. I just checked in with Zach about something. Last year, the state park put up these huge cyclone fences near Seabright, and it was done poorly and they weren't removed for 2 or 3 days. So I was just hoping that maybe our police department or someone in the city government could communicate with them to just do a better job, either putting them up so they don't stop pedestrian access or at least taking them down early next morning or something. So it was related. I just thought I'd bring it to your attention.
And I will note that because I've spoken with people in state parks who are responsible for that planning, they put together a binder. They review it every year. You should probably address your comment to them as well.
In other words, Cynthia Matthews, the mayor, is saying, don't bother me with your concerns about what the state parks does, even though it impacts the city and the pedestrian traffic here directly. I don't know quite what cyclone fences Michael Posner is talking about on Soquel Avenue, but I know that there were cyclone fences downtown during Halloween a couple of Halloweens ago, and they were really much resented by the community. Who many of us felt they further crowded people into smaller areas, and while you had these goon squads of police and deputies marching around, all outfitted in black outfits, it was really pretty distasteful. And I don't think it's something you want to see repeated on the 4th of July. I'm going to play the rest of this, then I'm going to pause for a caller who I got on the called in earlier, and I want to apologize for keeping him waiting. Caller, don't give up. If you're still listening, you're going to be on next.
The state parks. We'll bring him back, Mike.
Move the staff recommendation. Second.
Any other discussion?
Yes, my only discussion is that I think it's smart for us to be preemptive and proactive. There are huge numbers of people that visit our city, literally doubles the population of our community when these events take place on 3 or 4 days of the year. This is one of them. And it makes total sense for me that we plan ahead, have lots of police presence. It's difficult to predict the exact overtime cost, but we want to have enough officers on the scene to make sure that people aren't killed. And again, on these kinds of events, and I don't think they're all that different in some way, we've had a situation 1 year, Thanksgiving, when 11 people were stabbed down, 8 people were stabbed downtown, 11 people, but 8 of them seriously. And that's human life's at risk. And for me, that's worth doing what we have to protect it. So that's why I'm supporting this measure.
Okay. Well, I totally support it. I would also like to suggest, because we're now in our third year of doing this, at least, we've done it very successfully for Halloween and New Year's as well. And the discussion, I think, has become repetitive, and I'd like to maybe work with staff to bring forward an item that would just make this a standard procedure that could be then varied if needed.
Yeah, it's a Cynthia Matthews' concern about public comment being repetitive probably is somewhat similar. And I guess the concern about people complaining about their rights is a repetitive thing that she gets tired of hearing about too. But we hope that a lot more people raise their voices and repeat what happens to them, and stand together when they do so.
So that's not part of the motion, but I'm bringing it forward.
Just, since you raised it, if I could respond just briefly, I think it's helpful to bring this thing up publicly because it's part of the process of deterrence to let people know we're doing it and to spread word on it and have to do it on TV. So whereas it could be done, some, I assume you're proposing some kind of more automatic way. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a harm to bringing it up, asking a member of the public, to, you know, allowing a member of the public to speak longer on it and make clear to the public that we're going to do it.
So this may be the real reason that Rotkin allowed me to speak on the item, because he wanted to have the community become aware that they're going to crack down on 4th of July.
Okay. Well, I'm just looking at time for staff reports and so forth. But that's, again, that's...
You're managing the meetings, so I appreciate that.
Yeah. That was just a related comment, not central to the motion. So, any other comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously.
And that was a lot longer and more time spent on the city council meeting than I had anticipated. My apologies to those who got tuned out because of the loud hum or got tired of the city council or perhaps got tired of my interjections and interruptions. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Hopefully the caller who was calling in before will pick up the phone and punch the buttons, and looks like somebody's calling. Hey there, you're on Free Radio.
Robert.
Hey, is this Scope It Out Scott Graham?
Yes.
Well, speak up. What's up?
Oh, well, there's this morning in Capitola, the Rispin Mansion burnt down.
I see.
Which is, if for people that don't know, is an old nunnery on the side of Soquel Creek, which the city of Capitola bought some years ago, and they have just completed a deal with Barry Swenson to turn it into a boutique motel at the expense of the people of Capitola, another $3.5 million that they have to kick into the project. Now, Swenson, as you may remember from the days after the earthquake, was the major rebuilder of downtown, and there was a number of buildings downtown that mysteriously burnt down after the earthquake because Swenson didn't want to restore them. And I think that that's what just happened here. Although in the paper and on the TV, they're blaming homeless people for burning it down, much the same as happened downtown here.
Well, now, how can you say, Scott, that Swenson, what evidence do you have that, first of all, what buildings are you talking about that burned down after the earthquake?
There's the Trust Building, which was on the corner where, what's that bookstore, you know, Borders.
Uh-huh.
There was a building called the Trust Building there. There was the St. George Motel, or Hotel, or whatever it was called.
Hotel.
Which burnt down mysteriously and was blamed on homeless people, both of which were supposedly restorable, but Swenson didn't want to restore them. He wanted to build something new there.
I see. So you're suggesting that one of our major citizens, one of the backbones of Santa Cruz, is...
an arsonist.
Frisky with the matches, eh?
Yes, or people that work for him are... You know, I mean, he probably doesn't do it himself, but who knows? Maybe he does. Maybe he likes to play with matches. But
so, Scott, are you prepared to deal with the forthcoming slander suit that is coming up here? Again?
Oh, I'm sure they're listening to your show right now, Robert.
Regularly. Everyone listens to this show. You
right.
know that.
I know. No, but it just seems funny that, you know, the same homeless person, you know, years later shows up in Capitola and burns down another Swenson project.
It could be, you know, let me be the devil's advocate here. You know, people who start fires at night to keep warm, they can have accidents. I mean, unless you have some evidence, Scott, other than your own strange hostility to one of our leading citizens, Barry Swenson, how can I possibly find you credible?
I don't know. I think that maybe Madison would back me up. Who knows?
Madison is not in the studio with us. At least I wouldn't admit it if she were.
Yeah.
Any other reports, or have you any comments on anything you've heard today other than the poor quality of the broadcast?
Well, yes. You interrupt these tapes so often as if your audience is a bunch of three-year-olds that need constant lecturing on what exactly. Why don't you let them listen to it? And if people have questions about what they just heard, they could call you and ask you instead of you constantly breaking in. By the time you get done with one of your tapes, everyone's forgotten what the beginning of the tape was.
Oh, you can be a cruel taskmaster.
But, getting back to the Rispin Mansion, this afternoon I saw a Capitola cop harassing a homeless guy who was standing at an intersection with a sign, begging for money. And I've never seen the Capitola cops do that before, although I've seen the Santa Cruz cops do that. And I think that possibly this whole, supposed homeless arsonist thing is the reason they're out harassing the homeless people on the highways begging for change.
Well, it's possible that these arsonists, after first burning down the building, have now retreated to appear to be innocent spare changers on the median.
Yes.
Right. Well, hard to say what the hell happened. This is the first I've heard of it. I haven't not looked into it. But I want you to make sure that you don't misuse fireworks on the 4th of July, or you yourself will be burned.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm. Okay.
All right.
But anyway, I just brought this up to show that, whenever possible, the homeless population is brought up to be the boogeyman out there that, is responsible for all these terrible deeds, just like, the economic downturn, especially here in Santa Cruz where these trinket shop owners can't sell their wares. It's all because of the homeless people,
I know that, and you know that. That's why we're trying to teach them a good lesson tomorrow in Department 4 by sending them to jail for each subsequent act of sleeping, which is that's going to be happening at 10 a.m. Department 4 at 701 Ocean.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, have a good evening, Robert.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that just about wraps it up. I have just gotten an email on Craigslist. This is a report, 6:22 tonight, actually. DJ's Market Strip Mall at Water and Branson 40th Streets. A blonde female police officer driving car number 165 enters the parking lot, parks her car across three parking spaces at the far end of the lot, no lights flashing or sirens sounding. She gets out of the car and calmly walks into one of the shops in the strip mall. She appears on duty and is fully loaded. Without an apparent emergency, she did not park in any of the available parking spaces in front of the shop she went into. I don't understand, the person writes, why she parked this way. If it was merely to write a report or follow up with someone, she could have parked normally like everyone else. I'll try giving the benefit of the doubt, though it's hard considering the lack of evidence to support that she was responding to an emergency and needed to park the car hastily and illegally. And there's a picture of this squad car. It's not okay to contact this poster with services or other commercial interests. Sorry. So this is something that's been posted on Craigslist. Interesting. I, of course, made the same point. We've actually had an exchange with officers Forbes and Winston on this issue when they have parked blocking a lane of traffic near Taco Bell in what was apparently a non-emergency situation for 5 or 10 minutes. Then, of course, there was the notorious case of, I think it was Officer Forbes. I could be wrong. There are several Officer Forbes. I think it was Dan Forbes, but he can correct me, who parked for an hour in front of the Cinema 9 Theater, actually in front of O'Neill's, in order to intimidate a chalk artist from doing an erasable chalk art design on the sidewalk in front of O'Neill's. That one we broadcast on free radio. But I'm not aware that the police department has ever sanctioned for any of these abuses, and indeed, we pay for them. So it's just important to know what's going on as it goes on, even as they scream they're poor and that they're going to cut everybody's salary, except, of course, Dick Wilson gets to keep a much larger chunk of change than the rest of us, although I guess percentage-wise he's losing maybe he's taking a small reduction in his salary. I noticed also that there was a very interesting feature on the Santa Cruz Sentinel website, which I'm having difficulty finding now. It may be my own computer illiteracy, but there was a feature on the Santa Cruz Sentinel website that allowed you to go directly to, by putting in the name of any city employee, you could find out how much she made last year and how much overtime she was paid. Particularly interesting for the police department. And I've been Googling for that and looking for it, and it seems to be really hard to find. So I'm wondering if under pressure from the police they've taken it down. But I know how independent and fearless the Sentinel is, and perhaps they haven't. Just kidding, folks, about that independence and fearlessness. I will say the Sentinel did show up at Jack's yesterday during our demonstration dialogue when I was chatting with Connie. Rick and I were chatting with Connie, another Huff member in Connie's restaurant, about these rules, which Jack's now has committed itself to, that they're not going to discriminate against the homeless, that they are not going to discriminate against people who are sitting across the street, even if they don't like the idea of groups of people sitting on the lawn of the church. And they are going to restrict themselves very narrowly and very clearly to behavioral misconduct at the restaurant. And now, of course, the claim that Connie has is that she's always done this. The claim of those who've been evicted is not at all. They were essentially evicted time and time again for being across the street. So whoever you want to believe, the issue, of course, is, has the problem been resolved? And if it has been resolved, that's great. And I'm happy that Connie is doing this, and I'm hoping that the church reopens its property to poor people. And I'm also hoping that, you know, Ryan Coonerty grows a heart and a head. And I also hope, the rest of us grow some balls and ovaries and challenge him and the other council clones there into restoring civil rights to poor people in Santa Cruz. But frankly, it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot more protest. And, you know, it's as LBJ used to say, if you grab them by the balls, their hearts and minds will follow. Anyway, that's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm 10 seconds overtime already. Skidmark Bob is already in the studio with his hook. And it's time for me to leave the scene so we can hear nostalgic music from the 60s and 70s. Actually, I like that kind of music, which Uncle Dennis will give you from the Cream of the Dregs, except that I believe he's off around hiking in the Sierras or something. He's marching around somewhere out in the wilderness, and so this could be my opportunity to seize another hour, but no, it's Skidmark Bob in the studio. So I'm going to have to leave it. Please get back in touch with Free Radio again, at least for my show on Sunday morning, 7:30. I'm going to start real early, assuming I get up that early. And I'm also encouraging you to check out the Human Rights Organization, which meets every Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe. With the success of this Jack's protest, we're going to have to consider other places where similar problems exist and see if there can't be the same kind of mediated strategy after, of course, the abuses are exposed, or at least the alleged abuses are brought forth. So give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to be a part of this process, 423-4833. And again, I guess show up tomorrow, 10 a.m. at the court in Department 4 if you want to support Anna and Miguel and their right to sleep, not anywhere, not everywhere, as I continually say, but somewhere. And that's the issue for a lot of people tonight in Santa Cruz. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Let's go out on a little musica. How about something from the Turtles? Is that 60s enough for you, Dennis?
Yeah.
House on the hill, peaceful and still, only sounds of music ever fill the air. Birds everywhere, with ribbons in their hair, I'm so glad I had the time to stop and share. Thank you.
wanted to go. They made me happy, my only home. They know.
It's the 420 Drug War News, courtesy of KUOW and Steve Scherer of the Weekday Show. This is an interview with the new drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, and he's asked why he took the job.
It's important that in many ways on an issue as controversial at times as drug policy, that the administration speaks with one voice, that we're aligned on these issues. And policy, actually, it's not exciting. It's not like running a police department. You don't get calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. But in the long run, it's got the potential to make the country sounder when it comes to our economy, to get people back into being tax-paying, productive citizens who've been under the influence of drugs.
Will there be an effort on your part to reinstitute funding for federal needle exchange programs?
The needle exchange issue is one in which the use of the federal funds is still in existence in the 2010 budget that went up. Coming in,
I thought the president had taken that out of the budget. It's in the budget.
The ban is still present. Needle exchanges are looked at as part of a healthcare issue, reducing HIV transmittable AIDS issues, hepatitis C issues. So it's part of a larger healthcare issue. The other part is I didn't come into the position until after the budget was clearly finalized. So in the next 9 months, we'll have the president's drug strategy put together. I'll have an opportunity to weigh in on the 2011 budget, and that's where we want to see where we're headed.
You supported needle exchange here, yes?
Needle exchange in Buffalo, where I was police commissioner, and the needle exchange here in Seattle were not a law enforcement problem. They didn't cause difficulties from a law enforcement standpoint. It's much more complex than certainly just the law enforcement viewpoint. So that's one of the issues, too, along with medical marijuana that I'll be spending time on.
You know, for his whole tenure in office, the former drug czar, John Walters, avoided me like the plague. I've got a request in to the ONDCP for the new czar, Gil Kerlikowske, to come on this program and to clarify the need for everlasting drug war. Please, don't anyone out there hold your breath waiting for his response, and certainly not for a positive response. I appreciate Mr. Scherer's efforts. He asked some good questions, but not telling enough for this LEAP member. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Free film screening on Saturday, June 6th at 6 p.m. 500 Years of Chicano History. Viva la Causa. All ages are welcome to this event and presentation at Barrios Unidos, 1817 Soquel Avenue. Betita Martinez, filmmaker, author, historian, will be there. Joe Novato as well. Other folks in attendance to spread the word. 500 Years of Chicano History is a book. It's also a film. And the film is being put on by Bean John Brown and Barrios Unidos. For more information, email us at beanjohnbrown@gmail.com. That's, again, Saturday, June 6th at 6 p.m. at Barrios Unidos on Soquel, 500 years of Chicano history.
Tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. A public service announcement here. There's going to be an evening of radical films featuring Submedia's Franklin Lopez, a.k.a. The Stimulator, from It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. He'll be here in Santa Cruz showing an evening of radical films confronting fascism in an Obama era. This will be at the Sub Rosa Cafe, Friday, May 29th, 8 p.m., 703 North Pacific Avenue. $5 to $10 suggested donation. Check out subrosaproject.org or submedia.tv. Again, confronting fascism in the Obama era, featuring an evening of radical films with Submedia TV's Franklin Lopez. Sub Rosa Cafe, Friday, May 29th, 8 p.m., 703 Pacific. Be there.
This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm.
Public service announcement, Thursday, May 28th.
From 7 to 9 p.m. at the Police Community Room, Transition Santa Cruz presents The Transition to Walkable Neighborhoods.
An evening of films and discussion designed to move our community one step closer to a true walkability.
What is the future of transportation and land use in Santa Cruz? They'll intersperse excerpts from the films Sprawling from Grace, A Convenient Truth about Curitiba, Brazil, and City Repair, Portland, Oregon, with commentary from local transportation and land use thinkers David Foster from the City Planning Commission and Micah Posner from People Power. Plus time for discussion.
Again, May 28th, Thursday, May 28th, 7 p.m., Transition to Walkable Neighborhoods at the Police Community Room, 155 Center Street, Santa Cruz. Hey, no calls go. And yes, that's happening right now as we speak. It started an hour ago, if you want to check that out. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, and Uncle Dennis is on vacation. And he usually asks some of us programmers to cover his show, and I thought, hey, I haven't done a night show in years. I don't know how long. So, my name is Skidmark Bob. Working with Free Radio for a little while. So, we have a bunch of music for you today that, I'm going to follow the line of classic rock here on Free Radio, but it's going to be classic rock that I'm sure haven't heard before, or maybe you have. We'll be doing mashups and covers. Cream to the Dregs. Skidmark Bob, stay tuned. Freak Radio 101 FM, freakradio.org.